Thank you for joining us for Sermons on Demand from Friendship Grace Brethren Church. We provide these videos as a way to share the pulpit messages and teachings offered at Friendship Grace Brethren Church. If you find these videos a helpful resource, please drop us a note at info@friendshipgracebrethren.com. Now open your Bibles and get ready to dig into the Word of God.
Rich, before you get started, those of you that have church keys, I need them Sunday so we can turn them in. We have to turn all our keys in. So, thank you.
Okay, anybody have any questions this evening?
It's Wednesday, yes. Can we go to Psalm 122, verse 6?
Sure.
Are we supposed to pray this prayer or not?
Pray for the peace of Jerusalem. May they be secure who love you. That's not an injunction to Israel or to us. It is a general statement that we consider the peace of Jerusalem. For them, it was more significant than for us, because their relationship with God was tied to the land, and Jerusalem was the capital. And so they're looking, as verse 7 says, peace be within your walls and security within your towers. This is a prayer of David, a song of ascents of David, in which they would recite as they were heading up the trail to Jerusalem from all parts of Israel. And so this is not a command to pray it. It is here a principle that they should be looking toward peace in the center of their experience with God. So if you translate that into our world today, should we pray for the peace of Jerusalem? Well, yeah, because they're God's chosen people. Whether or not they're on the shelf now, they're still His chosen people. And Jerusalem will factor heavily into the end times. And it would be comforting to His people, both Christian people today and His chosen people, Jews of all time, for there to be peace in Jerusalem. And I think everyone from Netanyahu on down understands there never will be, at least until Jesus is on the throne. Now, whether Bibi Netanyahu believes it won't be until Jesus is on the throne, I don't know. But we understand that there won't be peace. And so essentially, when you pray for the peace of Jerusalem, you're praying for the millennial kingdom.
It's not a command, it's just a good thing to follow.
Right, right.
Can I add one to that?
Sure.
Jeremiah 29:7 says, "And seek peace of the city where I have caused you to be carried away captive, and pray to the Lord for its peace, and you will have peace."
Yeah.
That was Jeremiah what?
29:7.
Yeah, so go ahead.
I think there's a verse, and I don't know where it is, probably Linda does, but is there not a verse that says that if we pray for God's people, that He will bless us? Somehow or other, that sticks in my head.
There is a statement early on. If you bless Israel, that God will bless you. If you watch out for Israel, God will watch out for you. Whether or not that's a blanket statement that demands God do something for us because we look for God's God to deliver Israel, I don't think you can make that demand. But clearly, people understanding, understanding the juxtaposition of those who support Israel and those who do not. by and large, those who do not support Israel are being controlled or being swayed by a satanic influence. Has been that way ever since they walked out of Egypt. And so, praying for the peace of Jerusalem or supporting Israel, you know, what was the statement was made to Abraham, you know, those who, I will bless those who bless you. God knew that Israel would always be the odd man out and would be the subject of Satan's attacks, and the only people that primarily the only reason that the United States supports Israel is because we have a Judeo-Christian heritage that prays for the peace of Israel.
I think that's the only reason our country is still a country.
That
we have totally imploded.
The by and large, the people that are against Israel in our country are liberal Democrats, and they, by and large, I don't want to say every Democrat is satanic, but by and large, their ideology is satanic. I was proud of the new speaker today because he called them all out. He
yep.
said, "If you're supporting those kinds of ideals, you know, you're Marxist and communist, and they believed in no God, and that's what you're espousing if that's what you believe." So I was proud of him for saying that. But that's been the dichotomy all along. Those that support Israel and those that don't. Those that support Israel know God in some fashion. I'm not saying they're all Christian, but they know God in some fashion. Those that don't reject God.
Yeah. I'm glad I wasn't told to be crazy.
Well, that doesn't prove it, but...
Spoken like a good brother.
Well,
absolutely.
You can't tee him up and expect me not to hit him. Sybil, did that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
You're welcome. I know
they
I bloviated way more. I'm sorry?
They want me to speak tomorrow. How should we Christians, we German Christians, treat the Jews?
I think that's really a sensitive issue for modern Germany.
That's a loaded question.
Because I think there is a growing anti-Semitic influence in Europe, but there's still enough people around that have the feeling of guilt for Hitler that I think you're not even allowed to talk about. You would know Sybil better than me, but I think you're not even allowed to talk about that in public.
Yes, you are. What they resented that came out last week is that that Germany still has to do reparations. And then someone said, well, but I had nothing to do with it. And even I'm the oldest. I had nothing to do with it.
Right.
But they're kind of resenting the payments and then... And
yeah.
Then I got upset and I lit in them. I said, fine, but you expect us Americans to pay for you lazy Germans. And then we were going at it.
Yeah. I understand the sensitivity that Germany has about that conversation. It's disheartening to see anti-Semitism grow at the rate it's growing. But it's everywhere. It's satanic, and it's Marxist and communist, and we have a lot of people in our own government that believe it, and so I was proud of the new speaker to call them all out on that.
Believe
we haven't had somebody.
Here,
what?
Believe it or not, here in Podunk Rogers, in the middle of nowhere, we had a riot on the town square in downtown Rogers with people throwing rotten food and who knows what all else because begging the Jews and supporting Hamas.
Right, right.
In full Rogers.
Yeah, I love the homosexuals that back Hamas.
Yeah, that's hilarious.
They just have no idea what they're doing. Anyway, let's get off of politics.
Try it under Hamas.
Yeah,
see,
well,
keep it.
It's a minimum 10-year. It's a minimum 10-year hard labor in the Gaza Strip. So they don't know what they're doing. They just are following a mantra that they don't understand. Did you have another question, Sybil?
No.
Okay, anybody else have any questions? Go, Nance.
Okay, John 4:9. For some conversation.
The Samaritan woman said to him, "How is it that you, a Jew, ask for a drink from me, a woman of Samaria?" For Jews have no dealings with Samaritans.
And my question or thing that popped up to me, how did the woman know that Jesus was a Jew when she started talking to him?
I think the way to...
The dialect?
Yeah, there's several ways.
Yeah,
his clothes, for one thing.
Yeah, that's one.
As Sybil said, his dialect of Aramaic,
accent is Galilean.
Right, his being from Galilee, he said some things differently than they did in Israel or in Jerusalem, and a lot of things differently than they did in Samaria.
Yep.
When you remember who the Samaritans are, they are a mixed race of Jews that were left over when the 10 tribes were taken, and people from around the Levant that Assyria populated northern Israel with. And so they had their own, it's almost their own language. It's like if you are from New Jersey and you go to talk to somebody in the holler in Tennessee or Kentucky, you may use the same words. They don't mean the same thing, and they don't sound the same.
I just thought that was an interesting thing that, you know.
I love the story of the woman at the well.
Yeah.
And I never really appreciated it until studying with Tony, because the woman at the well is one of the gatherers that he talks about in gatherer training. You know, what did she do when Jesus confronted her? She went out and brought the entire town out to Jesus. She gathered toward Jesus. She wasn't a believer at that point, but she still gathered. It's one of the illustrations, and I love the picture of it.
Yeah, I just thought it was an interesting
topic.
Let's put it that
way.
That also said in one that I read, too, that the clothes that he wore might have been the shawl, the fringe shawl that he had on, and something that she recognized as a Jewish piece of clothing.
Right. Yeah, he didn't have any. He didn't have any formal school or any rabbinic training, so that he would have had a rabbinic prayer covering, but he certainly would have had a Judean markings on his on his clothes. The best picture we have of that today is when you look at the various Palestinians, you see them with their keffiyehs, and some are black and white checks, some are red and white checks. Those are different tribes, and they mean different things. And in Israel, you would see that same thing happen.
Just thought that was an interesting...
That's a great question, Nancy, because I never even thought of it. I just think they knew who Jesus was.
Well, how did she recognize him immediately?
Yeah. She probably didn't know who he was, because here he was, a Jew.
In foreign territory.
Yeah, in Samaria, and that was just a no-no.
Yeah.
When you think about it, the Galileans, they would rather walk through Gentile territory than they would through Samaritan territory. Going from Galilee to Jerusalem through Samaria was a day quicker.
Mm-hmm.
But they would rather go to the east side of the Jordan River, down through Gentile territory, and then cross the river at about Jericho and come in into Jerusalem from that way. And that was a lot longer than walking through Jordan, through Samaria.
Well, he had to know he was walking into
Yeah, he did it on purpose.
Foreign territory, so
yeah.
To speak.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I do have a question, but it's... I can wait till next week. I need to know it for the chairman, since we haven't gotten to it.
Well, go ahead and ask it.
Adulterous woman, is that part... Was that in the... I read today it was not in the original manuscript. And the grammar isn't even John's grammar, but you can answer that next week.
In what chapter?
John 8.
John 8.
That's for next week.
Yeah, we didn't make it to John 8 yet, did we?
No. And the Germans won't make it till John 8 next.
Okay.
So it's fine if I know next week.
Okay.
And your question is, what about her?
Was that in the original manuscript?
Oh,
I see. Never heard
okay.
that. I heard that today. And is the grammar totally different? It has not been written by John. It could have been a real happening, but it was not in the manuscript. So.
Yeah, I'm trying
My
to remember.
Bible doesn't say that, but. Yeah.
It's where he wrote something in the sand. Mm-hmm.
Okay, here's a good answer. Mm-hmm. The earliest manuscripts do not include 753 through 811. Some manuscripts don't include it. Others add the passage here or after 736 or after 2125 or after Luke 2138 with variations in the text. So I knew I remembered something about this. So if I remember everything correctly, it was always believed to have been actually an event in Jesus' life, but was not in some of the early manuscripts. And the earlier the manuscript inclusion is the key. If it's in the earlier but not in the later, it's clearly dropped. If it's not in the earliest, in multiples of the early manuscripts, and then appears, it's obviously added. And so most scholars believe it was an actual event. It is actually told in other text, but was added to John to complete the story, is what most, if I remember right, what most scholars believe.
Okay.
Let me see if I can pull up a commentary here real quick and determine that.
I have done the research and can't find anything on it. No one knows what Jesus wrote in the sand, but wouldn't it be interesting to know what he did write?
Yeah. We don't know. We'll never know.
No.
Well, we can ask him when we see him.
Right.
Yeah.
The NIV includes the entire segment, and whoever the author of Holman New Testament commentary is on John, it is Ken Gangle, so that's pretty good recommendation right there. He agrees that it should be there. One scholar calls it a text looking for a context and refuses to deal with it at the beginning of chapter 8, since in his view it disrupts the logic of the Johannine tabernacles argument. D.A. Carson agrees that the narrative was probably not part of John's gospel, though Zane Hodges from Dallas has argued its authenticity and claims there is little reason for doubting that the events described here occurred. That's D.A. Carson. He suggests it belongs to... Oh, Nancy froze. She's coming back. He suggests it belongs to the record of the last week, but nevertheless deals with it here as Gangle does. So. Hi, Nance. Welcome back.
Yeah, well, my other one died. It said the battery was low.
Oh, yeah. Doing Zoom eats up a lot of power.
Boy, I guess so. I figured I was good for an hour, but
yeah.
I lied.
Yeah.
Well, anyhow, I'm back on the tablet, so there we go.
okay.
So, Sybil, I would say, yeah, you can make the argument that it was not in the original, probably, but that it's authentic text, and it was an authentic event. Whether it belongs in John or not is a question. But most scholars believe that it was an actual event.
It has its own number in the harmony of the Gospels. So.
Right, right.
But
so, there you go. I love having computer tools.
Yeah.
Okay, any other questions? I love having questions, trying to figure them out. So keep them coming. Okay, here's my first question to you guys then. Let's read Mark 11, 15 through 19. And what do we learn about Jesus through this passage? Mark 11, 15 through 19.
Well, while we're finding it, why did we skip Luke?
Because the reading, we'll get to Luke. The reading series that we're doing has Luke coming later. And I'm... because it's following, oh, I forget what it is now. It's following. I'm sorry?
Is it following the Tanakh?
In the Jewish Bible, Luke comes like our Bible.
I can't, I'd have, just go to the to YouVersion and look. It'll explain on the plan why it is.
Okay,
Mark 11, 15 through 19. And they came to Jerusalem, and he entered the temple and began to drive out those who sold and those who bought in the temple. And he overturned the tables of the money changers and the seats of those who sold pigeons, and he would not allow anyone to carry anything through the temple. And as he was teaching them and saying to them, is it not written, my house shall be called a house of prayer for all the nations, but you have made it a den of robbers. And the chief priests and the scribes heard it, and were seeking a way to destroy him, for they feared him, because all the crowd was astonished at his teaching. And when evening came, they went out of the city. Okay, so what do we learn about Jesus through this passage?
He wasn't gentle, meek and mild.
He could get angry.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I refer to the modern view of Jesus as the post hippie, bell-bottom wearing, barefooted love child. That's the modern view of Jesus. And that is not the picture we see here. There's quite a bit of controversy or discussion, is probably a better way to debate, among scholars concerning the number of times that Jesus cleansed the temple. We have John recording it early in Jesus' ministry, while Matthew, Mark, and Luke record it late in his ministry. If you accept there were two occasions, then that's not a problem. If you view it as one, that they're telling the same story, then now you have an issue. Why is it put early and why is it put late? When was it, and so forth? I think there were two occasions, and they were separated by probably three or more years. So Jesus does it the second time because they forgot about it the first time, I think. So, depending on how you view that, I think there are different occasions. And as I said, there's a false understanding in our modern post-hippie world that Jesus was all about love and peace, and that's it. You know, that's what they talk about today, that Jesus was all about love. Well, yes, love is the commandment that he talked about most, right? But he was also about justice, and he was also about protecting his father's temple and so forth. The English phrase to drive out is the Greek word ekbalein. It's primarily used in reference to casting out demons. Now, John and the other authors could use other words to describe physically overturning the tables and stuff, I think it's important for us to recognize he's using a word that talks about casting out demons. Its primary use in the New Testament is about the apostles and disciples casting out demons from people. I think it's very important for us to see that. Ekbalane, I think, is an inference that Jesus is the authority expelling the workers of Satan. That's the picture I think the early readers of this text would see in their mind. It was like he was exorcising demons from the temple. That's the language. It would be like today, I would say, we went up to the old church building and we exorcised the all the garbage into the garbage can. You wouldn't see that as us picking it up. You would see that as a more sinister kind of thing, right? Because of the connotation of the word. Well, I think Ekbalane has that connotation, that the early readers of the Gospels would have seen that, and Jesus was in effect exorcising the demons from the temple. I think that's a picture that Mark and the others wanted to paint. There's also a sense that the action by Jesus was very forceful. Think about what they had to work with. Wood is not a real prominent item in Israel. We always think of Jesus as a carpenter, but really, carpenter is the wrong understanding of that description. We should probably see him more as builder. And what do they build out of in Israel?
Stone,
yeah. I think Jesus had big old arms on him because he was strong. The tables were not plastic fold-up tables like we have that we put into storage that, you know, weigh 10 pounds. These were hundreds of pounds heavy that he threw over. This was clearly an act of violence, and he wanted it to be portrayed that way. But what was happening is many people just thought, there's also the statement that not only did Jesus overturn the tables, he let loose all of the pigeons. Why does Mark specifically say he talks about releasing the pigeons?
They were used for a sacrifice.
Right. Who got to use the pigeons as a sacrifice?
The poor.
Right. And so what was happening in Israel is everybody was using the pigeons, so they didn't have to spend as much on their sacrifice. Isn't it interesting that immediately following this is the description Jesus talks about the rich people giving their offerings and the poor widow woman giving all of what she had? He's building a contrast, right? Because so many people in Israel were not doing the right thing. They were just using the pigeon as a scapegoat, if you will, rather than cost them for a goat or a lamb. So in reality, the people were shortchanging God on what he commanded to give him his best. God's command was, you give the best sacrifice, not the least. And they were shortchanging God on that. But now look closely at verse 16. Whoops. Come on, 16, there it is. And he would not allow anyone to carry anything through the temple. I don't know how many times I've read this, and I didn't see it until today. What does that mean? He would not allow anyone to carry anything through the temple.
People were using the temple as a path or a street to get from one side of town to the other instead of going around the temple.
Yeah, look on the map here. I'll make it full screen so you can see it a little better. coming from Galilee, they would cross over the Jordan at Jericho and they'd come in from the northeast. That's the upper right-hand corner of the picture. That's coming through Bethany and through the Mount of Olives. And then they would go through a gate onto what's today the Temple Mount and cross the Temple Mount, the court of women and the court of Gentiles, and go into Jerusalem. So here's all this commerce traffic not associated with the temple, just going through the temple complex. And Jesus said, no, that's not the way this is supposed to work. And so he wouldn't allow them to, he made it something sacred again. He wouldn't let them just use it as a public thoroughfare. It was to be a sacred place, even though it was the court of the Gentiles, even though it was the court of the women. Everybody was coming in one of the gates from the Mount of Olives and going across into the city rather than walking the half a mile around. I get why they did it, but it was making the temple no longer a sacred place. So Jesus made it so you had to use the proper sacrifice and return the temple to being a proper place, even if only for a day. But that angered the Sanhedrin and the Sadducees, because the Sadducees were in charge of the temple, and I wouldn't be surprised if the Sadducees didn't have a little toll box somewhere that people had to pay if they were going to walk through the temple and save that half mile. So Jesus turning over the money changers, and it was again returning the focus to the temple for its intended purpose, sacrifice for God, and a special holy place. You know, theoretically, before the Jews could go onto the Temple Mount into the court of the Gentiles or the court of the women, they had to first go through the mikveh bath. There are no mikveh baths on the northeast side. So they couldn't do what was required. Because if they were going to worship, they would come in from the west side and the south side. That's just the way it worked. That's where the mikvahs were. The wall, if you look at on the map, the right side of the Temple Mount is the Kidron Valley. It's a sheer 100, 200 foot drop off. And there were ramps that led to the gates. And there just was no easy way to do mikvahs there. And so if you were coming to worship, you went in through the south or the west side where it was much higher up.
That word drive out, that it had something to do with demons, was very interesting from what I taught in Galatians this morning. Because in Galatians it says that if we have faith in Jesus, then we are God. We are for Christ. Well, the opposite of that is if you don't have faith, who are you for?
Right.
You are for Satan. So
right.
These people had faith, and so they were for Satan. So it makes sense
right.
that Jesus was driving them out as in driving out demons. That just really hit me when you said that.
Yeah, it's a binary choice, Jesus or Satan. That's it. Little Harper has been talking about that. We've been doing a lot of talking out on the swing, and she said, good people follow Jesus and bad people follow Satan.
She's got it right. There's only binary choice.
Right. Okay, any questions on that?
So the Ekvi man seems to say that he also chased out the demons out of the temple. Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying that the author uses a word that is normally used to speak of driving out demons. I'm not saying they all were demons. What I'm saying is the author was using that word on purpose to build the corollary to those people that were not serving God but were serving Satan. Yeah, I don't want to go so far as to say that everybody there was demon-possessed. That's not the point. The point is that the word indicates the word choice. There were other words that could have been used to drive out or to overturn tables, however you want to phrase it. But the choice of the word that's most often used to speak of drive out demons indicates a play on words, if you will, that the Jewish readers would have understood. You know, I automatically think of demons if somebody says they had this exercised. I was reading a medical report not too long ago on some, I don't even know who it was or what it was, where they exercised some, maybe, no, it was, it, Linda, it was on one of those vet shows that we like to watch, where they removed a growth and they exercised the growth. And immediately I thought, was it a demonic growth? Because my mind, you say exercise like that, my mind goes to that position. And I think that's what the intent of Ekbalane was.
Okay. Well, isn't that just like what you said earlier, that the people who don't pray for the peace of Jerusalem are involved in being led by people who are Marxists or led by demonic authorities?
Yeah, now, I'm not saying they're... I'm not saying they're demon possessed. I'm just saying that it is a demonic influence that has pervaded the world since Adam and Eve. And I think in our video from the Engagement Project on last Sunday, I think Dell did a really good job of pointing that kind of dichotomy out.
Yeah.
Okay. Read Mark 12, 41 through 44. What's the primary principle in this passage? Mark 12, 41 through 44. And he sat down opposite the treasury and watched the people putting money into the offering box. Many rich people put in large sums, and a poor widow came in and put two small copper coins, which make a penny. And he called the disciples to him and said to them, "Truly I say to you, this poor widow has put in more than all those who are contributing to the offering box. For they all contributed out of their abundance, but she, out of her poverty, has put in everything she had, all she had to live on." So, what principles are in this passage?
It's not about the amount you give, but about how your heart is and what your motives are.
Okay, true. But build on that.
You give to God first, not the leftover.
Okay, still not complete, but you're build on what you said, Linda.
It's sacrificial giving. The woman sacrificed because that was all the money she had.
Which meant she had to do what?
Trust God for her provision.
Exactly. Why did God tell the Jews that they were to sacrifice their best animals?
So they had to trust God.
Yeah, it's not a... God doesn't need our money. He didn't need their money. It's not about the amount of money. It's about your heart, as Linda said, and does it make you trust Him?
Mm-hmm. You're more dependent on Him.
Right, absolutely, more dependent on Him. But there's another principle there. And I'm kind of confident you won't see it unless I point it out. And then you'll go, "How didn't I see that?" Because it stares you in the face and you don't see it. I didn't for a long time. I think this passage illustrates that we need to pay attention to what's going on around us. Look at the context of what Jesus is doing here. And he sat down opposite the treasury. By the way, the treasury was in the court of the women, the women's court in the temple complex. He sat down opposite the treasury and watched the people putting money into the offering box. Jesus was watching people give their offerings. Sitting down opposite the treasury box, opposite or in the court of the women, he could see people going in and out and giving their offerings. He was paying attention to their spiritual health or their lack thereof. And I think the illustration here is that we need to do the same thing. We need to pay attention to the people in our orbit. Are they being spiritually active? Are they being spiritually mature? Are they doing what they're supposed to be doing? Are they doing the very least that they can do and expecting God to bless? Or are they doing everything they can do? Are they being sacrificial in their time and in their giving not because God needs their money, because he doesn't. He can do it many ways without us giving money. But are they trusting God or not? Jesus was looking at that, and he's illustrating that. He's showing his disciples, who would become the first leaders of the church, part of the foundation of the church, Jesus said. And he was teaching them to do the same thing. Look at the people in your orbit. What is their spiritual condition? That's something we need to be busy about doing. And people always object to that. You know, they don't want to be held accountable. They don't want people knowing what they're doing and so forth. And I'm not saying that we should pay attention to who gives what, how much, and so forth. We need to pay attention to their spiritual condition. What was the way in Israel at the time Jesus illustrated this to the church, or to the disciples, that you could get a feeling of the spiritual condition? It's their sacrifices and their offerings. And we need to be involved in people's lives to know that about the people around us. We can't just assume they're doing good. We need to pay attention. We need to put ourselves in a position to see it. Jesus went into the court of the women and sat down opposite the offering box so he could watch. It's like going to the mall and people watching. That's what he was doing. And then he called his disciples over. And he look at verse 43. And he called his disciples to him and said, "Truly I say to you, this poor woman," he observed what she did, and now he's teaching them what he learned. Or what he observed is a better way to say that. We need to be involved in the lives of others so that we see those things go on with them.
But once we see, what do we do then?
Well, then we have to have the spiritual capital with them to be able to say something. Somebody that's not trusting, somebody that's always worrying, or whatever. You know, we gotta be able to say things to them. Or people that are doing it really well. We gotta be able to say things with them. It is part of building relationships with others. A lot of others don't want it. We've lost people from the church that didn't want it. But I think Jesus here is illustrating that's the way we're to live, the way we're to do it. Okay, time for one more. Read Mark 13, 14 through 23, and explain it, Lucy. Read Mark 13, 14 through 23. "But when you see the abomination of desolation standing where he ought not to be, let the reader understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let the one who is on the housetop not go down, nor enter his house to take anything out. And let one who is in the field not turn back to take his coat. And alas, for women who are pregnant and for those who are nursing infant in those days, pray that it might not happen in winter. For in those days there will be such a tribulation as not has not been from the beginning of creation that God created until now and never will be. And if the Lord had not cut short the days, no human being would be saved. But for the sake of the elect whom he chose, he shortened the days. And then if anyone says to you, 'Look, here is the Christ,' or 'Look, there he is,' do not believe it. For false Christs and false prophets will arise and perform signs and wonders to lead people astray, if possible, the elect. Be on guard. I told you all these things beforehand." So what's going on here?
Isn't it kind of a double prophetic statement by Jesus? He's talking about AD 70, the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple and the diaspora, the people being dispersed, and also the tribulation?
Yeah, more than double. I think it's a triple one.
Okay.
Because it is a word-for-word quote, a short quote. Go ahead, Sybil.
Yeah, it's the first one is Antiochus Epiphanes in 165 BC, I think, and then the other two that Anne said.
Right. Daniel 11:31 says, forces from him shall appear and profane the temple and fortress, and shall take away the regular burnt offering, and they shall set up an abomination that makes desolate. So Daniel says that about 500 years earlier. Then in, you were close on the date, Sybil, you missed it by 2 years. In 167, Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes raids the temple during the Maccabean era, and he barbecues a pig on the altar, and not only barbecues a pig, he forces the high priest and the other priests to eat it. And so you have that desolation, and then you have, again, what happens in 70 AD and the destruction of the temple. And there's pretty good indication that General Titus did some pretty profane things in the temple as well. And then you have what we all know, what we all think of in the coming of the tribulation and the sacrifice of who knows what on the altar as the abomination of desolation in the middle of the tribulation. So you have a three-way fulfillment of what Daniel said. In the passage, Jesus talks about if God hadn't shortened it, no one would survive it. Don't interpret
the tribulation.
Yeah, that's the tribulation, right? Don't interpret that God changes his mind. He always planned to be at that, for it to be that length, because longer, you know, 2/3, I think that's the number. I need to look up my notes from that, Linda. Remind me to do that. From when we studied Revelation to see what that number is. I think it's 2/3. When 2/3 of the world's population is killed during the tribulation, if the tribulation, say, was 9 years, there wouldn't be anybody left. And I think that's what Jesus means, that God planned it to be 7 because there would still be some that make it. And so this picture that Mark records there is a way of Jesus saying what Daniel said, and the way Mark records it gives us this picture that Jesus is tying what Daniel said to not only what Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes did, not only to the destruction that was not yet in Jesus' day to the temple, and what will come in the future. All of that is tied together. And that's a real powerful message about the authority of Jesus, the authority of God, and the accuracy of his word. Okay. Questions or comments?
Yeah, I just have one more. We're right in line.
Okay.
Mark 13:37. Just the last sentence. I think it's so prophetic.
Mark 13:37.
Just the next page.
And what I say to you, I say to all, stay awake.
I got that highlighted.
Yeah.
Stay awake.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's to look at the full pericope there, you know, starting in verse 32, but concerning that day or hour, no one knows, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, which I find it's a fantastic statement. Be on guard, keep awake, for you don't know when the time will come. The reality is, it could have occurred the day after he ascended. You know, in the 60s and 70s, that's what we were taught. Maybe even in the 80s, that certain things had to happen first. Nothing had to happen. He could have returned at any time, and he still can return at any time. Is it going to be today? I don't know. Is it going to be tomorrow? I don't know. Could it be 1,000, 2,000, 10,000 years? I don't know. But the imminent return of Jesus is a real doctrine, despite it's been 2,000 years and he hasn't yet returned. It's still imminent.
I just thought it was good because what I say to all.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a warning in that, isn't there?
Oh, definitely. I said that the prophetic warning. That's
yeah.
What I wrote down.
Yeah. Everybody needs to pay attention to what God has said. A lot of people reject what he said, but like you pointed out there, I say to all. God's word is to everyone. And pay attention.
Dan, what was your reference there? Cuz I was writing
13:37.
Thank you.
Yeah, that whole pericope starts in 32, yeah. 1332.
Uh-huh.
It's just after the lesson of the fig tree, which is a whole other mystery that I haven't solved completely yet.
Thank you for watching or listening to this teaching on demand from Friendship Grace Brethren Church. Please consider sending us an email at info@friendshipgracebrethren.com to let us know how this teaching may have helped you. Please also consider joining us in person at Friendship Grace Brethren Church, located at 10251 Metro Parkway, Suite 116, Fort Myers, Florida, just south of the intersection of Metro and Colonial Boulevard. Sunday school begins at 9 and worship service at 10 a.m. We look forward to seeing you in person at Friendship Grace Brethren Church.